Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 12:58 PM, the Pacific Summer Time. Today is October 25th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, if we look at what is leading the NASDAQ higher in here today, it's both Tesla and Intel. They paint two very different pictures. The fact that you have NVIDIA up 4% and in fifth position, and Advanced Micro Devices up in sixth position today. Well, that is telling us a picture here of where we have obvious leadership in terms of semiconductors. Then in the healthcare sector, well, Illumina and Gilead are leading on the downside, and it has been the biotech sector which has been under some stress over the last while. But let's take a look at the charts, because the NASDAQ hit a new all-time high in here today. It's been up in a dynamic manner this week. It has confirmed support in the region of the trend mean. This has looked like a bullish consolidation since at least May, when we had that very clear upside weekly key reversal. And it suggests that we are on the cusp of the 18-month period of, in fact, we're at the almost at the end of October. So it is really more like a 21-month period of consolidation. And in fact, when we look at the NASDAQ, it has looked more like a surprise decline in the last quarter of last year, followed by a resounding rebound more than a period of ranging. When we look at the S&P 500, it also moved on to a new all-time high in here today. This has got much clearer characteristics of ranging, but you equally have the large upside weekly key reversal in May, and subsequent to that, the index has continued to find support in the region of the trend mean. The clear potential here is that we are going to break on the upside. The Philadelphia Semiconductors Index has broken on the upside and done so in a dynamic manner. Now, when we think about the chart patterns for some of those semiconductor companies, well, Intel surprised on the upside with its earnings in here today. They are attempting to transfer their reliance on desktops into a reliance on servers, and the share has been largely range-bound since the first quarter of 2018. There have been some acute bouts of volatility during that time, but it is pushing back up towards the upper side of that range right now. NVIDIA took it on the chin following the collapse in Bitcoin and the ensuing collapse in demand for graphics chips in 2018, but it has pushed on to a new recovery high in here today. Now we have higher reaction lows, we have higher highs. This continues to look like a recovery. It was not looking especially promising in the first part of this year when it failed in the region of the moving average, but it is now starting to find support there, and that's rather important. Then when we think about AMD, well, this is a company with a great deal of debt, and yet it has had one of the most acute incredibly impressive bounces in 2018, almost equally impressive decline, then subsequent rebound. Now it is bouncing again from the region of the trend mean. The company does have some plans to try and deal with their rather large debt mountain, and it looks like investors are willing to at least give them the benefit of the doubt in the short term. Now, when we then think about what's going on in terms of the mega caps, well, Microsoft was really quite firm in here today following its earnings. The trajectory of the share has been transformed by the adoption of the software as a service business model. When we look at this on a weekly basis, then this consolidation that's been underway now for most of the last 4 or 5 months has been really very tight. It's allowed the overextension relative to the trend mean to just about be unwound, and now the share is pushing back up towards the upper side of its range. Microsoft is really trying quite hard to get into the server business and has been building its own server farms and rolling out cloud services. Google has hired a former CEO of Oracle to do exactly the same thing, and that share is back testing the upper side of its range. Google has been in the has been making headlines for the last few months, particularly with regard to quantum computing and its claim to have achieved quantum supremacy. Then we have they're certainly one of the top two in terms of autonomous vehicles, but neither of those is revenue producing at the present time, whereas their adoption of more of a cloud computing business model and a clear intention to try and grow that part of the business is probably one of the things that is material in terms of the valuation and the potential for earnings growth that could see the share starting to push on the upside here. So there are a number of different strings to this story. Tesla is the share that I think most people, or most of the bears, love to hate, but it was up again in powerful bullish territory again in here today. An additional 10% on the move that we saw yesterday. So this is a really rollicking performance compared to what had been a pretty depressing period where the share had given up much of its value. It has more than doubled in or just about doubled in the course of just the last few months. So there is a lot of short covering going on in Tesla right now. This is the biggest pop on the upside we've seen since at least this time last year. Now, this is a company that is trading very much on its valuation with regard to autonomous vehicles. Its initial big leg on the upside back in 2013 was with the release of an electric car that people actually aspire to own. Well, it's still doing that, and it has also been able to implement 8-to-1-to-1 battery chemistries, which are, on the one hand, they do tend to be more volatile, so you are going to see more cars on fire. That is one of the side effects. It's going to require more investment in shielding for the battery. But the flip side of that is these batteries tend to give more power, and they tend to go on for longer. And we've already seen that people have driven 100,000 miles in their Model 3s, and they have lost approximately 1-2% of the battery's charging capacity. Now, that's by treating the battery very nicely and really taking care not to under or overcharge it. But the bigger point is that the car can drive 100,000 miles in a year. All that needed to be changed were tires, and that there was very little in the way of diminution of capacity and potential in the performance of the vehicle. That's an incredibly powerful bullish characteristic for the share because it's a value proposition for consumers. Nonetheless, the company is trading at an eye-watering valuation. It's not only going to have to execute flawlessly in terms of delivering more vehicles if the incredible volatility of the share is to be tamed, but it's also going to have to deliver on autonomous vehicles. Now, Tesla is pioneering this camera way of thinking about autonomous vehicles rather than the LiDAR of Google and its Waymo project. And it's still a competition to see who's going to be correct, and I think it's quite likely autonomous vehicles are probably going to require both. But both of those approaches are heavily reliant on computer capacity and on the ability to sift through massive quantities of data. So there are two ways of thinking about this. In order to get to the end point of autonomous vehicles, well, first, we are going to have 5G. That's an enabling technology. You need to have the bandwidth in order to support these incredibly data heavy applications, then we need to have the wherewithal to process this incredible quantity of data. Well, that's where quantum computing comes in. It's also where highly sophisticated algorithms come in. Well, when we then think about the performance of some of the autonomy and artificial intelligence and robotics ETFs, well, they did really well in 2016 and 17, and not so well so far this year. But with Tesla starting to do better once more, then that should help to reattract investors back towards this sector. And the Robo ETF is now back testing its sequence of lower rally highs. So this is an important area where it needs to demonstrate that support is coming back in. Now, when we start to think about this in terms of the longer term, well, the pace of technological innovation continues to accelerate. And it's not simply that it's accelerating. It's, in fact, that the pace of that acceleration is also accelerating. In other words, innovation continues to come through at faster and faster paces. This is contributing to an inability to really comprehend just what the potential outcomes are likely to be, because it's going to be an incredibly powerful move in terms of innovation. It's going to be incredibly disruptive in terms of what of the effect that it has on economies, and that's going to be both good and bad. Technology is inherently deflationary. Well, the other way of thinking about that is it just takes less to do more. And on the one hand, that has productivity growth, clear beneficial characteristics. But of course, what it also means is that there is less need for additional people to fulfill roles. One of the most important characteristics of successful technology is that it eventually becomes invisible. And that is basically what an autonomous vehicle will be. It will be when the driver becomes invisible. It's exactly the same as when the DJ becomes invisible because you have the music on your phone. It's where the bookshop becomes invisible. These are some of the disruptive effects of technology. Well, then when we think about what are the positives, well, it's going to reduce some of the, or it's perhaps a better way of thinking about it, is that it is going to lubricate the wheels of commerce, that there will be more things for people to do, there will be greater room for creativity, and it is in creativity where we get true value starting to come through in all economies. It is in removing the obstacles to individual creativity that we can get the clearest results in terms of productivity growth. And it's productivity growth is what the global economy needs. But the big question is, if this is going to be so valuable, why hasn't it occurred already? Well, part of the reason for that is because the fruits of technology are not equally spread out, even though we now have a global environment where availability of technology goes global almost instantly. The application of that technology is inhibited both by regulatory barriers, with hubris that people simply will not change their minds until they are given a clear reason to and a necessity to change. And then, of course, there is the fear of that people will be giving up what they already have hard won. And I think that's part of the reason why we have this increasing volatility in terms of social peace and prosperity. There are really rather violent protests breaking out all over the world, and that has certainly been the case This week in Chile, but over the last few months in Hong Kong, it's certainly been the case in Syria and in Lebanon. When we start to look at the root causes of all of these problems, it's nothing to do with technology, but rather that the cost of living has increased. And there has been an inability for people to transition from what they had been doing to something that can cater to this new environment. The fact that we do have globalization, that has eroded the manufacturing base of a large number of countries. And I will certainly take the point that is made by just a succession of people that jobs in manufacturing were uncompetitive for a long time, and it was only a matter of time before they disappeared. That's some of those points are true. But exporting those jobs to the emerging markets and China in particular, with no regard for what was going to replace them, well, then that is something that has created very significant problems because it changed a gradual erosion into a sudden shock. And one of the most important points about manufacturing is because it is a volatile sector, it tends to pay well. And it is that pay that helps people who are not highly educated to achieve a middle-class lifestyle. The problem is that when mining shuts down and manufacturing shuts down, then less educated people have very little way or very few ways of having the same level of income that they had previously. They end up taking lower-end service jobs where there is much less potential for better wages. Well, that's a phenomenon that's going on all over the world, and the status quo is being challenged by the simple fact that people have had enough and they are revolting on the streets when they don't have the political wherewithal to express their views. And that is also responsible for the rise of populism, and this is not something that is going to go away. Well, what we've definitely seen this week is that there is increasing optimism in stock markets that there is going to be a trade deal, and that is part of the reason why we have the S&P and the Nasdaq at new all-time highs. And the easing of that uncertainty, it's certainly not going to remove the uncertainty, but the easing of the uncertainty should be beneficial for mid-cap sectors. And generally speaking, mid-caps are more reliant on the domestic economy than the international economy. Now, the Russell 2000 has been ranging for all of this year, and it really does need to push back above the 1600 point level. And I think until we see that, then I think it would be premature to sound the all clear. But what we are seeing is that the banking sector is doing better, and it has very clearly now broken up and out of its range. It has broken the sequence of lower rally highs. It has confirmed support in the region of the moving average. This looks like a recovery scenario. And when we think about the regional banks index, then it hasn't quite yet been able to break its sequence of lower rally highs, but we're getting really quite close. Well, this difference between the performance of the large caps and the performance of more domestically oriented sectors of the economy, that is also an allegory for the fact that it's the USA has not been completely unharmed by the trade war. If we do get an easing or a hiatus in terms of the trade war, then that would be greeted really rather well, I think, by stock markets generally. Now, let's then think about what's going on in terms of Europe. The banking sector there looks completely different to what it does in the USA, and not least because the European banks are still saddled with an extraordinary amount of debt. But they are at the lower side of this evolving base formation, and we are seeing evidence of steadying. Then when we think about what's going on in terms of the bond markets, well, 10-year bond yields are continuing to rise. We have higher lows and higher highs. There was a clear acceleration on the downside. It is at least going to unwind this overextension relative to the trend mean. But I do think that there is potential for additional upside here. If some of the uncertainty with regard to the global economy abates, then Europe should do better because emerging markets should do better. And when we look at the European stock market, well, it has been doing basically nothing now for really quite a while. The DAX index is pushing up and out of its range. When we think about the MDAX, which is the mid-caps in Germany, they are at the upper side of their range. When we think about the FTSE 100 in the UK, then there is still some uncertainty with regard to Brexit. And certainly Macron in France, in terms of he basically put the kibosh on the desire to get an extension of Brexit up to January 31st. But it is very unlikely that Europe is not going to grant the UK an extension of their deadline. Then the big question is whether Parliament is going to give Boris Johnson his election. Having said for so long that the Labour Party want an election, then it would seem that they would be accused of being cowardly if they don't in fact then go ahead and have an election. There is a fighting argument here that the deal that Boris Johnson seems to be intent on pushing through Parliament is in fact worse for the UK than Theresa May's. And therefore, is any Brexit better than no Brexit? That is something that I think voters and politicians have to really weigh. The big question for the UK is how much are they willing to pay in order to break free from the EU? I certainly think that the EU's trajectory is increasingly towards the United States of Europe, and the time to leave is now, because it will be increasingly difficult later. But the cost of leaving is looking rather high. Now, when we then think about the FTSE 250, it was in negative territory in here today, but it does have an upward bias, and it was off its lows in here today. So this is looking like a consolidation in the region of the upper side of the range. Of course, the pound is a major source of concern for a lot of investors, not least because of its volatility. And some unwinding of its overbought condition, especially around this psychological 130 area versus the dollar, is looking at, well, is already underway. The pound had also got up to test the upper side of its base versus the euro. We're going to have to see some of the uncertainty around the decision dispelled in order to really see the pound sustain a move up and out of this base formation. But of course, the other conclusion is that it does look like a base formation, and what that suggests is that the investment community is willing to at least consider that the UK is going to be okay, that we are going to get out of the EU despite the cost, but that it will be done it will eventually get completed in such a way that the UK will eventually have greater independence. But from a much bigger picture, this is a further reflection of the rise of populism and the revolt against the status quo and the desire to take back control for individual communities and for individual voters to have some dominion over the trajectory of their own lives. And that is a clear knockback to the idea of globalization and I think when we think about the longer term, it's reasonable to conclude that globalization, as it has been practiced for the last 30 years, is in fact over. But you can't simply unwind the kinds of relationships and intertwining of economies that took 30 years to create overnight. And what that suggests is that this trade war is not going to end overnight, that any agreement that can be come to is only going to be modest in nature and potentially short-term in nature. Everybody knows that there's going to be a presidential election in 2020, and we also know that President Trump can't run for a third term. He is obviously very interested in staying in the White House, if for no other reason than to avoid being prosecuted in court. But it would also afford him an unparalleled opportunity to express his geopolitical view with no regard for his election chances in future. That's something that is a substantial risk going forward. We also have to think about the fact that we are in the US presidential cycle. And the US presidential cycle is that in the latter half of the third year, which is right now, we do get a substantial rally. And if the market is breaking out now, then there is the potential that we are in the middle of, or perhaps I think a better way to say it is we're at the beginning of the breakout phase. The fourth year of the presidential cycle is usually the best, and in terms of the 4 years' performance. So there is obviously the potential that we do get additional upside for Wall Street in here. The big question I think that is sitting out there for investors is what's going to happen to the dollar in this kind of environment. The dollar was firmer over the last 4 consecutive days, and it has found support in the region of the trend mean. The Federal Reserve is now at a point where it is increasing the size of its balance sheet. It's added about $200 billion over the course of the last 6 or 7 weeks. It has clearly broken the downtrend in terms of the reduction of its balance sheet. So we can say that the reduction of the balance sheet is over. The reduction of the balance sheet, however, had been one of the clearest supports for the dollar. But we also know that that $200 billion was part of a repo facility, and the Federal Reserve is unlikely to engage in outright quantitative easing until they absolutely have to. Whereas the ECB is going to be adding $20 billion worth of assets to its balance sheet every month for potentially years. And that is also representative of the fact that they don't want a strong currency. And the euro has been trending down in a reasonably consistent manner for nearly 2 years. And there is obviously a clear intention in Europe that they need a weaker currency. They have got a recession risk in Germany, and that is having a knock-on effect for a number of countries in the region. Against that background, it's hard to argue for a strong euro. The Japanese economy is also in a period where I think people are starting to ask questions about sustained growth as they try to raise the sales tax again. The yen has now come right back up, or sorry, the dollar has come back up to test its succession of lower rally highs and test the region of the trend mean against the yen. If it pushes up and through this 109 area, then it would have broken the downtrend. Well, a weaker currency has been one of the strongest fundamentals for the nominal price appreciation of Japanese assets, and the Nikkei was up again in a dynamic manner this week. It has clearly now cleared the 22,000 level, and this looks like a first step above the base when we look at the longer term chart. Well, I think this is important. If we just simply strip away all of the arguments and just look at the chart patterns, the Nikkei went sideways for decades, and on each of those occasions when it was going sideways, every time it got up to 20,000, it failed and went on and made a new low. And that ended all the way back in 2015. It got up to 20,000 and made a higher reaction low and then broke out. And we've had a consolidation above this 20,000 level for most of the last couple of years. Well, this does look like a first step above the base. It looks like we're going to see Japan doing better from here. When we look at the FTSE 100, then it has first step above the base characteristics too. And when we think about it in those terms, then there is the potential here that this entire ranging phase, where the FTSE basically went sideways for 3 years following its breakout, has been just a first step above the base, and that the risks are on the upside. One of the things that I think is most acute in the UK is that the vast majority of retail investors are not really invested in stocks. They're mostly invested in property. And the property market has been one of the most rewarding internationally for UK investors. They have done spectacularly well from property. But one of the reasons for the willingness to invest in property is because there has been nothing on offer from the stock market for most of the last 17 years. Well, if this is a first step above the base, it suggests that there is the scope here for the UK to enter a new bull market. And then I think when we look at Europe over the long term, the Europe stocks index has been ranging below 400 for the last 20 years. Well, usually when we see these 20-year ranges being completed, it's suggestive that we're in new bull market territory. Of course, nobody is willing to make a bet that Europe is about to embark upon a new secular bull market. It's almost impossible to make that argument when you look at the challenges that are outstanding for the region. It's one of the most unloved internationally, and yet we're seeing these markets pushing on to at least test, potentially break up and out of these longer term ranges. So I do think that this is a region where it is time to start paying attention, not least because Europe trades at a relative discount to what we're seeing in the USA. All of the earnings growth in the USA is coming from the technology sector. Without the technology sector, it would look a lot more like Europe. Now, if we're starting to see Europe starting to break on the upside, Japan breaking on the upside, then what that is suggestive of is that there is a lot of liquidity sitting on the sideline. There is more money that is likely to be encouraged into the market. With Wall Street breaking on the upside, this is the time when people will start to look for bargains. Rather than feel like that they need to chase higher multiples, they'll either deploy a momentum strategy and chase the winners, or they'll try to find something that has the potential to play catch-up. Well, Europe and Japan both have the potential to play catch-up just because they have not been doing much of anything for what feels like really a rather long time. Well, then we need to consider what's going to happen with China. The index continues to pause around this 3,000 area on the A shares. I think one of the best barometers we have, and we don't have a lot of good barometers for China, is the Shenzhen B shares. There are no banks in this index, and it isn't packed with the same number of state-owned enterprises as the A shares. And this index is right on its lows. It has a lot of work to do in order to really demonstrate that we're back in a demand-dominated environment, but at least there is a short-term oversold condition, so there is scope for at least a bounce in here. China has been diversifying away from investing in property and infrastructure for most of the last few years. Because the state has not been investing in those sectors, it resulted in a massive amount of money getting siphoned out, or really the creation of a shadow banking sector in China. And that is one of the reasons why they've started to allow defaults, because it's defaults on private capital. The problem is that China has run into some of the same problems as the USA and Europe and Japan did, in that once you stop investing in manufacturing, infrastructure, and property, then you don't have a ready answer for what's going to take their place. Then we have the fact that if we're talking about productivity growth, well, China does have an incredible opportunity in front of it, that they now have millions of college-educated people. And some of these people are incredibly entrepreneurial, and they have successfully built businesses out of nothing. And they have certainly been assisted in doing that by the government. But the problem with trying to keep that process going is that once you unleash creativity, it's very hard to control in what direction it goes. And you do hit barriers in terms of what you can do and what you can't do if you can't express yourself in a free way. And that is one of the challenges that China is coming up against. There is a reason why Russia trades at a significant discount to just about everywhere else. It's not that you don't have incredibly well-educated people in Russia, and it's not that it doesn't have enormous physical resources, but the reason why the index trades at a PE of 5 is because of the geopolitical uncertainty, the lack of governance, the fact that minority shareholder interests, a free judiciary or a free press are under threat. And to the extent that those things are under threat constantly under threat in Russia, well, they don't exist at all in China. Well, therefore, making an argument that valuations are dirt cheap in China just does not make sense if you start to then apply a governance quotient. And I think that's one of the most important characteristics. When we think about emerging markets or markets of any hue, then we have to apply governance as an overriding or just an overlay against which we can measure the relative attractiveness of assets. Now, the Russian market is doing better from here. They have been cutting interest rates aggressively, and industrial resources are starting to do better. That is also a reflection of the hiatus that appears to be underway in terms of the global environment. When we think about the continuous commodity index, it has now broken its downtrend. It's been pretty much going sideways for the last 4 years. So if it can do better from here, then that would help to bolster the view that commodities are starting to recover. Nickel has been the clearest and best performer in terms of the industrial resources, not least because of its use as one of the primary constituents of batteries for electric vehicles. The commodity that most people pay particular attention to is copper, and it has not quite yet been able to break its sequence of lower rally highs. One of the greatest applications of technology has been in the oil price and the creation of an unconventional oil and gas sector, which did not exist a year or a decade ago. It has resulted in the USA becoming energy independent and, in fact, a net exporter in October of this year. Well, when David and I first proposed that almost a decade ago, we ran into a lot of pushback. People really did think that we were mad for thinking that. Well, it's already happened. It has completely changed the geopolitical makeup of the world. But what we have also got ample evidence of is that bull markets in commodities are defined by steps in the marginal cost of production. And when we look at the long-term chart of oil, we can see that there is plenty of evidence of these long-term steps. The long-term steps can last anything up to 20 years. They can sometimes last even longer than that. But when they do break out, we go into these just phenomenal bull markets where the price has the potential to go up by 10x. We saw that in the all the way back here in the 1970s. The price went from 2 to, well, it went to 40, so that was a 20x move. But then it went from 10 to 140, so 14 times. Well, what that suggests is that the next time we have an oil bull market, that the price will go to anywhere upwards of $400 to $500. But we may not see that for at least another 30 years. That's one of the most important points, that we're now in one of these lengthy ranging phases. And these lengthy ranging phases last a phenomenally long time. When we then think that the marginal cost of production has gone up, that all the way back in the bear market between 1980 and the early 2000s, there were a significant number of producers that could pump oil at profitably at $10. They were making plenty of money at 30, and there was a lot of people thought it was completely unsustainable for prices to ever be sustained above 40. Well, we've had a massive amount of new supply coming onto the market, but most of it has a break even in the order of about $50 for domestic onshore production in the USA. Well, what that also tells us is we've just had a step higher in terms of the marginal cost of production. It means that there will be occasions when the marginal cost of production is exceeded and the price falls through 50. But what we also know is that it won't be sustained because the globe will need that additional supply. Obviously, the argument is that we're not going to be using oil for the transportation sector any longer. What that therefore means is that there is going to be a revolution in terms of refining, and the focus is going to be on creating additional products. Whether that is going to be in terms of food production to feed a global population that is multiplying, or whether it is going to be to fuel rockets to promote a massive advance in space, whether it is going to be in a revolution in terms of material science, in terms of nanotechnology, or in terms of the production of different kinds of plastics. These are all potential use cases for oil that tend to be overshadowed because of the production of gasoline for the transportation sector. When we start to think about colonization, well, then there is the potential that you're going to need a massive quantity of fuel to get to other planets. And if that were to occur on a mass scale, if we start to think about the outlook for the space sector, where there is quite likely to be people walking on the moon within the next 2 years, and on Mars within the next 10 years, and if we start to think about what that means for 30 years from now, then that is something that has clear potential to create a new bull market in oil. But it's going to have to be a massive new bull market story. And that's a hard one right now. Now, when we think about where prices are right now, well, we're at the marginal cost of production. And supply is starting to come out of the market. The oil price is right at the lower side of this range that's persisted for the last couple of years. There is potential that within the long range, between $40 and $140, that we're going to get spikes from the low to the peak. If we start to think about what it is that could kill off a bull market in the wider market, well then, surging oil prices is one of those. If we were to see oil prices surging up to $100 in an aggressive manner, then that is the kind of thing that creates a recession. The other big point to pay particular attention to is jobless claims. You simply can't have a recession without people losing their jobs. If continuing claims rise, then that's generally because people aren't succeeding in getting jobs. Now, one thing that we can certainly see is that the pace of the decline has been moderating. And if this starts to trend higher, then that is going to be a suggestion that we are entering the very latter stages of this bull market. The one thing we do have to be aware of is that there is the outlook for a recession is increasing following the inversion of the yield curve that we had about 6 weeks ago. We don't generally have to worry about an inverted yield curve until it is surging through 50 basis points. The one thing that we do get after an inverted yield curve, generally speaking, is a very positive move in the stock market. And what that suggests is that we could get the bull market extended first and the recession afterwards. And that, I think, is the base case, that when we think about what the outlook is for the market, we get the bubble first and we get the recession afterwards. It's the technology sector that is leading on the upside. It is the technology sector where the high valuations are. It's in the technology sector where the big promises are being made. We do know that there are challenges out there, that there is an absolute wall of debt that has been built up over the course of the last decade. The clear dynamic moves that we're getting in treasury markets suggests that the lows are in terms of the yield, that we are going to see the yield go all the way back up to the upper side of this range that has been persisting since 2012. What that suggests is the Federal Reserve is done with cutting interest rates. It would be reckless of them to continue cutting interest rates with the stock market at new all-time highs. What that suggests is that there is potential here for bond yields to continue to move higher because there is less demand for a safe haven. When we then think about what's going on in terms of the gold market, we know what the challenges are going to be. We know what the outlook for the global economy is going to be, that with a significant move on the upside on Wall Street, the potential for bargain hunting in Europe and Japan, with the potential that the trade war becomes less of an issue for the next year, then we can get a spectacular move on the upside in terms of markets. That will increase bubble risk, which will potentially force the Federal Reserve to start raising interest rates again. That will increase the potential for a recession. We already know what that potential scenario is going to be. That is going to bring the question of modern monetary theory back onto the front page. That's why gold is continuing to hold this $1,500 area. It has broken clearly out of this base formation between 2012 and 2019. As long as it is holding the breakout, then we can conclude that we're in a new bull market environment. If we do in fact move towards the kind of money printing and coordinated easing by both the government and central banks together, then that raises the scope for outright currency war and investment in a safe haven in order to clearly demonstrate, or at least to lend solidity to people's view on what in fact money is. There has certainly been some commentary that Bitcoin is the new gold. I really don't hold, I don't believe that that is a cogent argument. But that doesn't mean that Bitcoin can't go up. And it went up in a very dynamic manner today. It had broken down from that range. It absolutely needed to push back up and into it. It has now posted a failed downside break. This is a clear upward dynamic. There are a number of reasons being attributed to it. One is that some of the futures we're getting up to the expiry for futures. So if people had used the opportunity of the release of the backed futures back in September to short, then they could potentially be closing out those bets in here today, or they're at least being asked to roll them forward. But there was also the speech by Xi Jinping in support of blockchain. Bitcoin is essentially a Chinese cryptocurrency. The vast majority of mining to sustain the network for Bitcoin takes place in China. So if they are now willing to at least lend tacit support to the blockchain technology, then that is either a direct response to Mark Zuckerberg testifying in Congress today and using the threat of China as a way to try and get some support for his Libra project. China may be, in fact, just simply responding to that and saying they're willing to support blockchain in terms of this competitive environment. So there is that potential, but simply looking at the price action, this kind of upward dynamic does not happen every day. It is suggestive that support is coming through in the region of the trend mean, that we are likely to see additional upside from here, and that we're back in a recovery type of scenario. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.